This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York City ruled against the state of Vermont in its efforts to shut down the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant in Vernon. The appeals court did rule in favor of the state on one point, saving Vermont from having to pay Entergy's several million dollars in legal fees. Brad Ferland is with the Vermont Energy Partnership, which supports Vermont Yankee. He welcomed yesterday's ruling and says the legislature's action and the lawsuit it prompted have set Vermont back in energy planning.
Many of us were watching it, and it was a very emotional, political-driven process, which doesn't belong in energy policy planning. So it didn't make sense at the time. And then to sort of push it forward to, you know, require lawsuits to sort it out, we've lost a couple years of what I would consider prime time for, you know, really solidifying a good energy policy.
And Ferland says it's time to bring Vermont Yankee back into the state's energy portfolio.
My hope is now that with this ruling with Vermont Yankee that we don't omit Vermont Yankee from the energy planning process. This is a good time just to wipe the slate and revisit it and look at it with new eyes.
But Governor Shumlin's administration is dedicated to closing Vermont Yankee. Today, we're going to look at what this ruling means and what happens next. Joining me first in the studio today is VPR's John Dillon. Hi, John.
Hello, Jane.
So let's get right into it. Entergy sued the state of Vermont over two laws, Act 160 and Act 74. Remind us what those two laws actually do.
Basically, they gave the state legislature much more of a say in the plant's continued operation. One Act 74, passed in 2005, says Yankee needs a vote of the legislature for nuclear waste storage for waste generated after March 21st, 2012, and that obviously affects their continued operation if they don't have a place to put it. And Act 160, you recall that was the big vote in the Senate a couple years ago, that put the new 20-year license in the hands of the legislature. Since the Senate didn't move that forward, Yankee didn't get legislative approval.
But in suing the state, Entergy was basically saying not about those laws, that they were illegal, but that Vermont was interfering in federal jurisdiction over nuclear safety, and those laws aren't about safety. So how did that argument work?
Right. Those laws, because everybody knew that safety was a preempted issue for states, don't mention safety, as you say. So what Entergy did effectively in court was to go to the legislative record. They mined the record really effectively. They used in a trial court before Judge Garvin Murtha, sort of the mother of all PowerPoints, with audiovisual displays, texts of the legislative debate that the lawyer would highlight, and you'd hear the recording of lawmakers talking about safety. So they effectively convinced the judge that they may not have used the word safety in the bill, but safety was preeminent in the lawmakers' minds.
So that was the original ruling. Garvin Murtha said safety was imminent. He agreed with Entergy, ruled against the state. Now the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has said, yep, we agree with Judge Murtha.
They completely agreed with the judge on that point with Murtha, and they even went further, sort of implying bad faith on the part of the legislature. At one point, they used language saying they repeatedly demonstrated awareness of the potential for this preemption problem and disguised their comments. So they were saying that legislators were sort of being deceitful.
All right, so that's the lawsuit, that ruling handed down by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday. Meanwhile, what's been happening at Vermont Yankee?
Vermont Yankee's continued to produce power, but it's not being used by Vermont utilities except what they may buy on the market. And the nuclear industry, meanwhile, has seen – and Vermont Yankee has seen sort of the economic world shift under its feet. I mean, they're facing really tough competition from natural gas, gas generation, and the cost of power has been something that Yankees had to deal with. Entergy has had to actually lower the price that it keeps on the books for that plant. Meanwhile, they're looking at very substantial repairs needed in the future. So there's some analysts in financial circles who are saying these older nuclear plants, including Entergy's Vermont Yankee plant, may not be continuing to operate for much longer.
We've also seen layoffs recently.
That's right. 30 people laid off company-wide. Entergy has laid off people. It's a tough time for the nuclear industry.
Unlikely, though, that the state of Vermont is just going to wait and see what happens with the nuclear industry. Where does the state go from here?
Well, there is a separate state review of Yankee's request for a new 20-year license. They've obviously gotten a federal approval, but they need a state certificate of public good. Hearings on that wrapped up before the Public Service Board a couple of weeks ago. There won't be a decision until late fall, early winter. The board was free under Murtha's ruling and then under the Second Circuit decision to continue to look at non-preemptive issues, preempted issues such as economics, the impact on the environment, and whether Entergy Vermont Yankee has been a fair partner for the state of Vermont. So I expect their decision to be based I have no doubt their decision will be based on those grounds, either pro or con. They're not going to stray into areas of safety.
So there's the PSB process, but there's also a potential appeal.
There is. The state has 90 days to decide whether to take this to the U.S. Supreme Court. It has 2 weeks or so to ask whether to ask the full Ninth Circuit Court to review the case. Really interesting part of this decision was a concurring opinion from Judge Susan Carney, just a short opinion. It's on our website. People should go look at it if they're interested. And it basically, she invites an appeal from my reading of that.
Which is interesting, a concurring opinion, so siding with the majority here. I mean, it was a 3-0 decision, and then she's saying, but there's some
room
here.
She's saying, but because she believes that the court, the earlier court, the 1983 Supreme Court decision on which these other court decisions have been based, perhaps interpreted the Atomic Energy Act too restrictively as far as states' powers go.
That's VPR's John Dillon. He's been reporting on the Vermont Yankee case throughout, and we have all of his reporting at VPR.net. John, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Jaren.
And now let's turn to Attorney General Bill Sorrell, who is weighing whether or not to appeal that ruling, perhaps even to the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorney General Sorrell, nice to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, Jane.
So John Dillon just told us about the possibilities that might be available to the state on appeal. A couple of options, as he mentioned. There's asking all 9 judges on the Second Circuit to look at the case or possibly appealing directly to the Supreme Court. What are you contemplating?
Well, just those things, although the shorter time frame is the so-called en banc review by the full Second Circuit. I don't want to say no way, no how, but I think that is unlikely. I think that's our current thinking. We just got this 50-plus page decision yesterday, so we're still going through it.
But we should say 50-plus decision that was ruled on by all 3 judges. All 3 judges concurred, so you think you wouldn't be likely to get an overturning on all 9 judges?
One of the things that any litigant would typically consider when losing before a 3-judge panel is whether it's a split amongst the 3 judges, 2-1. If it's 3-0 all one way, then it's more uphill sledding to get the full court to overturn the unanimous decision of the panel. And then there are some other considerations relating to that, which I won't bother to go into right now. But I think the bigger question for us, of course, is whether within the 90-day period do we decide to seek review by the U.S. Supreme Court.
You going to take the full 90 days on that, or do you have a leaning one way or the other already?
No leaning right now. We've got a lot of legal analysis ourselves to do, and then similar to the process that we went through in making the decision to appeal to the Second Circuit, we took our full allotment of time to make that decision, and we talked with a lot of different individuals and organizations, including obviously the governor and his staff, the Department of Public Service, legislative leaders, and others to make that decision. And we will follow a similar process this time. And, of course, we hired a very well renowned Washington, D.C. law firm, and its senior partner, David Frederick, one of the most experienced federal appellate litigators in the country. They helped us consulted with us at the trial level, but they played a very, very active role in the appeal at the Second Circuit, and David Frederick argued the case for us at the Second Circuit, and so we've already been in touch with them, and those conversations will continue, and their input would be weighed quite heavily by us on whether it makes sense to seek Supreme Court review.
Of course, is the state willing to spend more money? We've now lost twice a lot of money to appeal to the Supreme Court. But let me move on, Attorney General, because we have you just for a short time.
Okay.
When we look at these court decisions, Judge Garvin Murtha's first decision and the appeals court decision, in both cases, they really studied lawmakers' interventions behind the laws that they passed, not just the face value of what the law says. And as John Dillon was telling us, really said lawmakers were thinking about safety, even if their words didn't include safety. Do you think the courts were right to read into lawmakers' motivations?
No, I think both courts, with all due respect, got it wrong, just in the same way that the federal trial court and the federal intermediate appeals court got it wrong in the Pacific Gas and Electric case, the case that John Dillon mentioned, where the U.S. Supreme Court in 1983 basically reversed the lower courts and said, no, we are not going to go into the weeds of the legislative process, cherry-pick statements by a relative handful of legislators, and then assume that those few legislators spoke for all members of, in that case, the California General Assembly. And we think that the lower courts have just gotten it wrong here again, just as the same thing in the Pacific Gas and Electric case. You know, it suggested they pulled statements from legislators and witnesses for various hearings and such. But it's a total of about between maybe a dozen and two dozen people speaking, some of whom were legislators. And I think it's a leap to say that those, let's say, dozen or so legislators spoke for all 180 legislators who thought the law of Vermont ought to give our legislature a clear say on the continued operation of the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. And I don't think there's any question but that the decision, particularly yesterday, the tenor of it was really quite insulting to Vermont legislators.
Well, on that note, and moving towards what you might be able to use in an appeal should you decide to go that route, one of the judges wrote at length about why she was reluctant to agree with the lower court, although she did. It was a concurring opinion.
Yes.
But Judge Carney said there needs to be more clarity around what it means for a state law to be grounded in safety. Why is that so pivotal in this case?
Well, we're in a question. We're in an area of whether there's federal preemption, where and under our system of government, what is not exclusively reserved for the federal government, the states have flexibility. And so that's what the basic fight is anytime there's a preemption issue. And there's no question that states have legitimate concerns as it relates to nuclear power. And is building the plant or continuing to operate a plant good for our economy? Is it good for our infrastructure? What are the environmental issues? Quite apart from nuclear waste, there's a thermal discharge or temperature of water that Vermont Yankee releases into the Connecticut River. State has a legitimate concern about water quality in the Connecticut River and the effects on fish life and such. Those are all, among others, legitimate state concerns. And there were any number of instances in the legislative record where we pointed out legislators talking about those kinds of issues that are legitimately state concerns. And for some reason, both lower courts in this case so far have essentially ignored those statements, or even worse, said, well, they were just said for the record. That's not really what the legislators were concerned about. They were all concerned about safety, but they said these other things to try to mask what their true intentions were. I mean, both decisions, the trial court decision and the Second Circuit decision, in our view, do not adequately respect the separate but equal branch of the government, the legislative branch. And by taking the statements of a few and saying they essentially were involved in this sort of scam where they were saying one thing but they were thinking another, and those few legislators who did that, who spoke up, actually were speaking for all the rest of the 160 or so Vermont representatives and senators who ultimately voted in favor of the laws giving our legislature a say. So, you know, we think the court, both courts, again, with due respect, got it wrong, and we're going to make a decision as to whether to seek Supreme Court review.
All right. And Attorney General Bill Sorrell has 90 days to seek a Supreme Court review, or just under 2 weeks now to look at an en banc review from the Second Circuit Court.
And Jane, I just want to repeat that, you know, the decision was good for us and that we saved probably $6 million. So the decision yesterday could have been a lot worse for us if not only was Judge Murtha affirmed fully, but that the state was on the hook for Entergy's millions and millions of dollars in legal fees. And we won that piece of the case, and Vermont taxpayers ought to be happy about that. That alone makes the appeal to the Second Circuit worthwhile.
We're looking at yesterday's ruling on Vermont Yankee, where the Second Circuit Court of Appeals upheld an earlier ruling allowing Entergy to continue operating the Vernon nuclear plant. Reaction now from Vernon Representative Michael Hebert. Representative Hebert, nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you tell us from your perspective what value the plant has to Vernon and to Vermont? And I assume from your position, you think it should continue to operate.
I do. It's been run safely for a number of years, and I think it can continue to run safely. As far as positives, I mean, it is a clean source of energy, and, you know, setting aside the waste materials, you know, it's a very low carbon footprint. It's a reliable source of energy. It's baseload energy. You know, when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing, it's producing electricity, and it's fairly economic in its scale. Right now, with the price of natural gas, it's not as inexpensive as natural gas for producing electricity, but certainly it's a very positive benefits to production and reliability. Also, no small measure, the 600-plus jobs that are at the plant itself, the surrounding community, the jobs that are generated because of the existence of the plant, it's a huge economic impact, not only for Vernon, but Brattleboro area, the Windham County as a whole, and for the state. The state gets a lot of tax revenue and other revenues from the plant itself. So there are a tremendous number of positives for keeping the plant going.
Well, given that, what do you think the state's next move should be? We were just hearing from Attorney General Sorrell on whether or not he's going to appeal the decision of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Where do you want to see the state go?
Well, my position is the same as it was before the appeal. I would really like to see the state and VY negotiating rather than litigating. I mean, the road we're going down is very expensive for both parties. I share the Attorney General's relief for the taxpayers that, you know, we're not going to be paying VY's fees, but that doesn't exempt us from the fees for the state itself. It's a tremendous expenditure. What I would like to see is to negotiate, as I said, negotiate rather than litigate. You know, for the administration to sound UI and find some common ground and stop taking such a strong adversarial posture with people with DUI. I mean, I've spoken, you know, the last couple of days with people from DUI, and they would welcome the opportunity to open a dialogue once again with the state to resolve issues in a positive fashion, which would mutually benefit the state and the plant. and in turn would benefit the people in Vernon and the surrounding area. So I would really like to see, rather than more litigation, how about an honest effort? Both parties come to the table, sit and be open and honest with one another about what's going on and what they'd like to see for resolution.
You think that could happen, though, that given the way the state reaction has gone so far, seems perhaps unlikely?
I'm not sure if it could happen. I think it could happen from what I've talked to the VUI folks. They're willing. It would be the administration's position. You know, if the governor signaled for his folks to, okay, sit down and see what we can resolve before we spend more money and more litigation, see if there are any avenues, rather than just instantly be going to court, because this adversarial relationship isn't good for anyone. It causes a lot of insecurity in the communities. There's a lot of insecurity as far as the financial stability for Vernon and Windham County as a whole. It creates great concern, and I think I, for one, and many people would be greatly relieved to see people sit down and have a positive discussion about the continued operation of a reliable plant like VUI.
That's Vernon Representative Michael Hebert. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay, have a good day.
As we have heard, the Public Service Board is still looking at the Vermont Yankee case, determining whether or not to give Vermont Yankee a certificate of public good. Let's turn now to Public Service Department Commissioner Chris Recchia. Chris Recchia, nice to talk with you again.
Nice to be here, Jane.
So, as we look at this case, Public Service Board process, board has to determine whether or not to grant VUI this new certificate of public good, which is basically a new operating license in effect. How is the PSB going to keep its process in the clear based on yesterday's court rulings about safety?
Right. Well, at the top of the hour, John Dillon and Attorney General Sorrell outlined some of the areas that are within the Public Service Board's purview. I would say that, you know, from the department standpoint, we've been there all along, and we feel very confident that we're staying within the bounds that have been outlined. We knew what those were to begin with, and we've been focusing on those.
In other words, you're not looking at safety issues, not looking at radiological issues. You're looking at economic issues, other kinds of environmental issues.
Correct. And operation of the plant in terms of a good partner for operating, a good operating partner. And the court also identified, you know, the likelihood that Entergy would be able to comply with laws. So those type of things are being considered as well.
So hypothetically here, if the Public Service Board denies Vermont Yankee a certificate of public good to continue operation, what are the options for Entergy then to appeal?
Well, any appeal would be to the Vermont Supreme Court. But at the moment, as you might imagine, we're pretty focused on the Public Service Board process and getting through that. And we've completed the technical hearings. Briefs are due, and then reply briefs in September. You know, we would expect a decision in the fall or late winter or early winter at some point.
So it could be as early as November, you think?
I really wouldn't speculate. The board has a lot of material before it, and it wouldn't surprise me if it took it several months to get through that.
From what I've been hearing, people are expecting December or January for
okay.
a ruling.
Yep.
Now, Entergy, though, could appeal not just to the Vermont Supreme Court but back to the federal court, couldn't it, and say, look, federal law preempts the Public Service Board process. That's one avenue.
Well, they could do that, but I think that, you know, of course, Entergy can do anything it wants. What I would say is we've been participating actively, and Entergy has been participating actively in the Public Service Board process. It got an original certificate of public good, or, you know, at that point, the owners of the plant did, and it asked for renewal of one. The time to raise that issue strikes me as having passed, but anything is possible. What I would say about the court ruling yesterday is I think that narrowed the ability to go to federal court on those issues.
So you lead the Department of Public Service, as I said, and you represent the Shumlin administration. Can you just briefly outline the argument that your department has made before the Public Service Board on this case?
Well, because it's still an active case, I don't want to go into too much detail, but it definitely covers the issues that we have talked about. But
what are we talking about when we say economic issues and environmental issues?
Okay,
I mean, there are several things that have been out in the public that people know about.
There are, and I think what most of our effort has been focused on the fact that Entergy has not been a reliable partner in implementing the agreements that they have had with the state. And in addition to that, there are several environmental issues, including the one that was mentioned in terms of discharge to the river. And the economics of the impact on the state of Vermont for not only continuing this path, but what paths are we foregoing, in particular with regard to renewable energy and our energy plan, to find a different way to support Vermont's energy future, and how does continued operation impact that? So those are the type of areas.
Given that the state doesn't have any contracts with Vermont Yankee, how does it have any impact?
Yeah, see, this is where I would say, and I think the court got this wrong on a technical issue. They implied that, or they said, because this was a merchant plant and Vermont was free to buy or not buy power from it, that it had no effect on our ability to do this. But in reality, it's 600 megawatts taking up space on the grid that, you know, we wish to displace, frankly, with renewable, clean power of Vermont's making. And the court clearly did not understand that technical issue there.
Just quickly before we let you go, Commissioner Recchia, how has all of this legal maneuvering that we've now been in for several years affected ratepayers?
Well, because the whatever is on Vermont Yankee's side, because we're not getting power from them, that's having no impact on us. And in terms of the work that we're doing through the PSB process, there are mechanisms in place so that we don't have to pass those. Are not being passed on to the ratepayers is really the straight answer.
So not much impact.
Not much impact.
That is Public Service Commissioner Chris Recchia. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
VPR will continue to look at the Vermont Yankee case from all angles. Please keep checking in at vpr.net for the latest. Coming up, we'll look at domestic violence in the context of several recent murders that appear to be tied to domestic violence cases. And listeners, if you have questions about law enforcement training or the effectiveness of restraining orders, we are going to open the phone so you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this week, Vermont State Police reported the deaths of two people in a suspected murder-suicide in Fairley. Police said a preliminary review indicated that Troy Gray shot his wife, Rhonda Gray, and then himself. They also said Troy Gray had a history of domestic violence, including an arrest in July for a domestic assault charge. He was released on conditions not to harass his wife, possess firearms, or enter their house. Police had been called to the home just the day before the shootings. This is the most recent in a spate of homicides that seem to be connected to domestic violence. And we're going to look now at the effectiveness of restraining orders, the rights of victims in these cases, and the training that law enforcement officers receive. We are opening the phone line, so listeners, if you have questions about domestic violence or experience that you'd like to share, you can call us now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post online at vpr.net. Joining me now is Karen Tronsgaard-Scott, Executive Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and Vermont State Police Lieutenant Ingrid Jonas. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so let me start with you, Karen. There have been some very high-profile cases, as I mentioned. There was the case in Fairley just this week. There was a case in Danby recently, another murder case. There was a case in Peacham earlier this year. Several other cases where women have been assaulted, brutally assaulted, not murdered, but very brutal assaults. And a lot of these, you know, obviously are tied to domestic violence. So are we seeing an increased level of domestic violence in the state? Is this a trend?
That's a great question, Jane. You know, we don't think of this as being a trend, but more of a spike. Back in 2008, we had 11 domestic violence-related homicides in Vermont. That placed us at a level that was second per capita in the country for domestic violence homicides. And so we see that that we do have these spikes every once in a while. Back in 2008, we were able to work with the law enforcement community and with the legislature to pass some laws around training for law enforcement. personnel that's been very effective. And you know, but this is a terrible summer, and it's mostly terrible for those victims and for those victims' families. And our hearts go out to them.
Is one of the difficulties here that in Vermont, when we start to look at numbers, our numbers are generally so small because we have a small population that it's difficult to tell trends from just a random uptick?
I think that's part of it. You know, we know that since 1994, over 50% of the homicides in Vermont have been related to domestic violence. So this is a big problem. We know that approximately 65% of violent crime occurs in Vermont residences. So in a state that, and we pride ourselves at being safe, our homes are one of the most dangerous places we can be.
Before I move on, just as we're looking at trends here, I mentioned that we've seen a couple of murders recently and some murder-suicides and some very severe assault cases. Are we mm-hmm. seeing an escalation in violence, if not an escalation in terms of the number of assaults?
I wouldn't say that. What I would say is that we are seeing an escalation in the number of people that are coming forward for help. So we know that in 2012, the member programs of the Vermont Network served over 8,000 people. They answered nearly 20,000 hotline calls. And we've seen a steady increase over the years. We attribute that to increased awareness, certainly, but also as you know, social systems break down, people have fewer options, and so they stay in violent homes for a little bit longer. The economy certainly plays a role in this, not just because of what's happening inside the home, but what's available for help and support outside the home, the options that victims have to escape
violence. In other words, funding for programs.
Funding for programs, that's an important aspect of this. But also, you know, as we take a look at our social system, our social, our network, our safety net, our social safety net, sorry. When we take a look at that, that also plays a role in the availability of services to support survivors and the availability of help for them when they're in crisis.
Lieutenant Jonas, what is the procedure for someone who perceives a threat from their partner? What do they do if they perceive a threat, they want to get a restraining order?
They have options. They can reach out to a network agency in their county to seek assistance with filing for a civil order, which is called an abuse prevention order. They can call the police, and the police can also facilitate that process to happen.
Are restraining orders effective in preventing domestic violence?
Well, I mean, that can be debated. I think that it's an individual victim's decision to make, and that's so important. I think victims need to be guided and get assistance in helping figure out whether this is the right route to take or something else. But certainly the idea behind a protection order is just that. It's a court order that gives police something to enforce. And it's meant to send a serious message to the offender that you've been put on notice by the court that your actions are unacceptable.
You come at this from a couple of perspectives. You're a state police lieutenant, but you were also an advocate for domestic violence victims before you became a state trooper.
Yes.
So what might be the reason not to get a restraining order?
Well, again, I am in support of the idea behind the order. I think that we also know that that unfortunately when victims take stands to protect themselves, sometimes the abuse can become more dangerous or worse. And so the order can sometimes be experienced as just a piece of paper, and it doesn't stand up enough in the face of the kinds of violence that the victim has experienced. They don't trust that this can keep them safe.
So similar to how we sometimes hear that victims face an increase in abuse or are more often likely to be murdered when they're actually in the process of leaving, a restraining order could escalate the violence because although it's just a piece of paper, it does say to the perpetrator, I'm taking steps. I mean, is that one of the issues here?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think that that's that fear is legitimate.
Karen, I see you nodding.
I agree with Lieutenant Jonas. I would also say, though, that the Vermont courts issue thousands of protection orders every year, and the vast majority of those protection orders are very effective. It's one of the most effective tools we have in the fight against domestic violence and in keeping victims safe.
We are talking today about domestic violence. We're learning a little bit more about how the restraining order process works. We're going to talk, too, as well about how police members get some training in domestic violence. And listeners, if you have questions, if you have thoughts on the process, our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or you can send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. Let's go to Jana, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Jana. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was wondering, I believe I heard of a program, I believe it was in New York City, that identified cases that were particularly likely to end in murder, in homicide, and that this program basically identified those cases and took initiative to restrict the perpetrator's movements rather than to put the onus on the victim to be able to report violations of restraining orders. It actually, for some cases, fitted the perpetrators with an anklet that would actually let police know if they came within 150 feet of either the victim, their place of work, or their residence. Is that anything that Vermont might be able to implement?
Jana, thanks very much for the call. Karen Trunscott-Scott?
It's a great question and a very timely question. In fact, Rutland, Vermont is one of 12 sites in the country that just received a grant to implement this very program. It's called the Domestic Violence Homicide Reduction Program, and the law enforcement community, along with the member program, the Domestic Violence Program in Rutland, and the other county law enforcement agencies have just begun work on implementing this program. It will be a long process. There's a lot of planning to get this. It's called a high-risk domestic violence high-risk multidisciplinary team that does take a look at, identifies the high-risk domestic violence perpetrators in the community, and then takes steps to kind of maintain control of that perpetrator. And we're really excited that Rutland was chosen to be a part of this demonstration project, and we think it holds great hope for the rest of the state. We're so unique in Vermont because we're small. So the plan is to take, once we do this work in Rutland, to take this statewide.
And when do you think that might be?
Probably the grant just began, so we're probably looking at a timeline of around 4 years.
How are the most high-risk offenders identified?
Well, there are. There's a project called the Lethality Assessment Project that's happening in currently in Rutland, here in Chittenden County, and in Washington County. And this trains law enforcement officers to ask a very specific set of questions, and to say some very specific things to victims at the crime scene, and these questions help them identify victims who are at high risk.
And Lieutenant Jonas, in Vermont, if a victim of domestic violence doesn't want to pursue a case against the perpetrator of domestic violence, what recourse do state police have in continuing to pursue a case?
Well, that will go back to the quality of the investigation that we conduct when we respond to a domestic case. Our perspective is that we need to proceed with gathering information, evidence, and whatever we can, with the assumption that the victim will not choose to participate in this in the future. And that is oftentimes the case. The victims are not willing to participate for a host of reasons. And so we need to proceed with our investigation without relying on that victim. In fact, not relying on the victim keeps the victim in a safer position.
So the state has the ability to pursue a case regardless of what the victim decides for him or herself?
Most of the time, yes. There's other means or other types of evidence that we can gather to support the elements of the crime without just the victim's statement.
Let's go to another call. Peter's on the line from Eden. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I worked as a paramedic for many years in Connecticut, and I was witness to many incidences where police, and I feel it's secondary to lack of appropriate training in dealing with violent domestic violence. And it's sad that we don't try to train our police officers almost to the level of a bachelor's degree in psychology with an emphasis on nonviolent communication. And I think that's something. And I also want to comment on the Vermont State Troopers. I mean, I had a lot of contact with them when I first came to the state. I had a lot of speeding tickets, and I dealt with the police. And I want to comment, the Vermont State Police are very professional, as it goes for police. But there are a lot of police officers out there who are very unprofessional in the way they go about it. I understand the police have to, at times, assert themselves to de-escalate a situation, but there's also times that they can do things with empathy and compassion.
Well, Peter, let me jump in here because you're making a good point here about training, and that training does incorporate things like empathy or how you deal with people in this kind of situation. And we've talked with the state police before that this is also one of the most dangerous types of situations for law enforcement officers to get in the middle of is domestic violence. So let's turn this to Lieutenant Jonas about what exactly police training is in domestic violence and if it's enough. We're not talking about a bachelor's degree level of training in domestic violence.
We're not, but we're talking about training that is mandated by state law for law enforcement, whether you're part-time or full-time certified in the state. And if you do not participate in this training, you will not remain certified. So it's taken very seriously by law enforcement and by the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council that oversees the process of mandatory training for law enforcement.
So law enforcement gets 8 hours of training initially, and then there's follow-up training as well?
That's correct.
And Karen Trenskart-Scott, your organization, the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, has some role in supervising and overseeing mm-hmm. and determining that training.
That's correct. We walked hand in hand with the law enforcement community to get this legislation passed a couple years ago so that we could make sure that 100% of our law enforcement officials in Vermont have this really important training. And, you know, I'm pleased to say that the law enforcement community takes this very seriously, and we think it's making a difference.
But are all law enforcement officers on board? Do they have the appropriate reaction, state of mind about the seriousness of domestic violence, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I'm not privy to what happens at the scenes of domestic violence cases. I'm not there, and I'm not a law enforcement officer, so that's not my area of expertise. But what I can say is that.
But you hear from a lot of victims.
Sure, and what I can say is that these are very difficult cases that have lots of mitigating factors. We also know that batterers tend to be very manipulative, and victims, even when the police are there, sometimes don't feel safe. So it's very complicated, but. You know, we know from research and we know from experience that this training is probably one of the most important things we've done in Vermont to combat domestic violence.
And Lieutenant Jonas, do you think law enforcement is taking this seriously enough, has the right state of mind in dealing with this? Peter said sometimes law enforcement can be aggressive or can do things that don't seem to be in the right frame of mind in terms of empathy.
I think that the answer to the question is yes, we are doing a good job. I think we can always be working to improve and build on these skills and learn more about having victims feel comfortable enough to tell us what's really happening, establish whether there's been a history and what context this violence took place in. These are investigative skills that you develop over time as a law enforcement officer and with experience.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here. Sally's on the line from Lindenville. Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Hi. It's interesting because this is exactly the line that I was going to make my comment to. I think there's a difference between, I think that this is not happening with all police. I think there is a culture of suspicion from many police. I think that training does not stop deep-seated beliefs in many police officers that they're not all of one cloth. I think that many times when women at the scene maybe hysterical, maybe have, before they arrived, have pushed off, have left any kind of mark from trying to protect themselves, women are often arrested by mutual fray. They're often not believed. And then as one of the two women said, they then become frightened of the police themselves and don't want to go back to them. And sometimes tell the police when they come to the door that no, everything is fine, or they drop the restraining order before court because they are afraid when the police come or that the police are not going to come soon enough.
Yeah, Sally, you're really highlighting a lot of the complications here in these kinds of situations, and I really appreciate your call. Sorry to cut you off there. Karen, we're running out of time, but can you speak to what Sally is talking about here? I mean, not only is this a highly tense situation when law enforcement is involved, but there are so many emotions, and so often the victim, him or herself, is conflicted about how to react.
Certainly, and we certainly see this in when we, especially with people who live at the margins of our society, it's terrifically complicated, and they may have a history with law enforcement that would lead them to not trust those law enforcement officers at the door. It is a very complex situation.
Well, I really appreciate both of you being here just to illuminate this conversation that we are having in light of some of the news events that have happened recently with some murder-suicides and some pretty serious assaults that are involved in domestic violence cases. Important to know what the resources are as well. We're going to put those up at vpr.net for people who need to find them. Vermont State Police Lieutenant Ingrid Jonas and Karen Tronsgaard-Scott, Executive Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow, a discussion of genealogy. We're switching topics altogether. And the fascinating stories that come alive when people go digging for details about their ancestors. Have you researched your family history? You can share what you've learned by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net, and then be sure to tune in to that discussion tomorrow. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.